Bien, chers amis, je m'excuse pour ma voix, mais je pense que vous me comprendrez. Nous allons donc reprendre, et je dois d'abord excuser le professeur Ossola, Carlo Ossola, qui aurait absolument voulu être avec nous cet après-midi pour vous répéter l'hommage des professeurs du collège à Jean-Pierre Vernant, que vous avez déjà entendu par la voix de notre administrateur, Pierre Corvol. Mais malheureusement, Carlo Ossola est pris par la présidence d'un autre événement unique qui a lieu aujourd'hui, donc qui ne peut pas être déplacé, et il est absolument désolé. Et il m'a dit de vous dire que dans les suites qui seront données à cette manifestation, il voudra s'associer de toute façon aux travaux. Moi-même, je suis heureux de sauter à sa place, si vous voulez, parce que je peux apporter une petite note comparative à cette rencontre, celle du groupe des Romains du centre Gernet. Il n'était pas très grand, mais il comprenait quand même une petite troupe, Jean-Paul Brisson, Marcel Benabou, Florence Dupont, Jean Andreau, moi-même, et puis des jeunes qui sont venus s'associer peu à peu. Et beaucoup de ces Romains, c'est mon cas, ont appris à penser le monde antique, que ce soit l'économie, le travail, le religieux, avec et autour de Jean-Pierre Vernant et au centre Gernet. C'est un autre exemple de l'incroyable fertilité de son enseignement, de sa méthode, qui apparaît à travers cette province, cette paroisse un peu lointaine, les Romains, qui regardaient avec bienveillance, mais une bienveillance un peu amusée, lui pour qui déjà les Macédoniens étaient quelque chose entre la barbarie et le néolithique, et nous, alors vous imaginez. Mais nous avons absolument pu bénéficier de cet enseignement dont quelqu'un a dit hier qu'il y avait des potentialités dont on pouvait ouvrir l'éventail et qui devenait productif dans des domaines très différents. Et nous pouvions ainsi, avec lui, apprendre une autre façon, beaucoup plus globale, d'approcher les sources en dépassant les techniques que nous apportions, épigraphiques, philologiques ou archéologiques, pour essayer aussi de relier ces problèmes antiques que nous examinions au monde d'aujourd'hui. Et je crois que Jean-Pierre Vernant est peut-être un des parfaits exemples de cet enseignement typique de cette maison et d'autres maisons où il a enseigné, qui consiste à enseigner une recherche en train de se faire et une recherche libre qui avance et qui change en cours d'enseignement et en tout cas qui forme par le spectacle de cette recherche en train de se dérouler. L'une des choses que nous avons tous appris dans son séminaire et au centre Gernet, c'est notamment comment aborder les images, comment travailler avec des images, comment notamment travailler sur la religion, sur les rites, avec ou à partir des images. Il est clair que dans ce domaine encore, son enseignement, les séminaires qu'il faisait, les groupes qu'il animait avec d'autres étaient absolument marqués une révolution dans la façon de travailler sur les différents corpus. L'une des manifestations les plus connues de cette spécialité du centre Gernet, c'était une exposition que beaucoup d'entre vous ont vue, qui a déjà été citée, celle de la Cité des images, qui a circulé en Europe et en France et que les Parisiens ont pu voir à la station de métro Châtelet, notamment dans les couloirs. C'était extrêmement, je crois que c'était Châtelet, c'était extrêmement intéressant. Et cette exposition n'était que la pointe émergée d'un iceberg, évidemment, et derrière tout cela étaient des recherches, des séminaires, des entreprises animées ou protégées par Vernant, au sein d'un groupe constitué par François Lissarague, qui malheureusement lui non plus ne peut pas être avec nous aujourd'hui, il n'est pas aux antipodes, mais pas loin. Françoise Frontisi, Jean-Louis Durand, Alain Schnapp, Jean-Pierre Darmon, qui tous avec lui animaient des images, des séminaires sur les images, auxquels sont venus se greffer ensuite Marie-Christine Villanueva et aussi une photothèque qui est toujours existante. Donc une série de cours, une série de manifestations et de colloques, de publications aussi, certaines ont été citées, qui ont permis à beaucoup d'entre nous, comme je l'ai dit, d'utiliser ou de comprendre à peu près les images, à lire les images. Et les Romains aussi ont appris par ce biais, même s'ils n'avaient pas de vase peint ni ancien, à lire leurs propres documents sculptés et notamment des travaux de jeunes, une thèse de Valérie Huette par exemple, est issue de cette inspiration. Et aujourd'hui, nous avons des communications cet après-midi qui vont illustrer, relire, repartir sur les thèmes que je vous ai très rapidement exposés dans mon incompétence. Le premier orateur que nous entendrons est Richard Neal de l'Université de Chicago, qui est un spécialiste de peinture grecque sur vase, mais pas seulement, il a aussi ouvert, il a un champ beaucoup plus large, il s'intéresse aussi aux Titiens ou à des peintres français, en dépassant ses frontières, et puis, je l'apprécie en tant que barbare, il s'intéresse aussi à la sculpture, qui a toujours été un des déficits iconologiques du centre. Donc je lui donne la parole pour parler sur les statues, se demander notamment si les statues étaient des sémata, et donc la sculpture archaïque après Vernant, à partir notamment, je suppose, du fameux Colossos qui lui aussi a déjà été cité.
Merci. Thank you, John, for that very kind introduction. Okay. Well, Jean-Pierre Vernant's work on figuration in early Greece deserves, I think, that most overused term of praise, a paradigm shift. Speaking personally, I began my own career as a connoisseur working on Athenian pottery in the J. Paul Getty Museum. And when I first read an article by Vernant, I had one of those very strange feelings of the whole world sort of shifting on its axis. It's for that reason that I feel especially honored to have been invited here today and to speak about Vernant and to reread him. And I'd like to thank Stella Gérald-Goudy and Françoise Frontisi-Ducroux and the other organizers for extending the invitation and for their hospitality. Today, I'll quickly sketch out some of Vernant's arguments about Greek art, tomb sculpture in particular. I'll then juxtapose these arguments with a set of very different claims about images and signs culled from the late writings of Ludwig Wittgenstein. And the goal is to clarify some features that remain, to me at any rate, confusing in Vernant's account. But the goal is not to criticize Vernant. On the contrary, my hope is that juxtaposing his arguments with those of Wittgenstein can help us better to see their importance and indeed to deepen them and extend them. Now, in a landmark series of articles, Jean-Pierre Vernant argued that the early Greeks conceived statues not as images, but in effect as signs. As we were reminded this morning, his initial intervention in this regard came as part of Ignaz Meyerson's conference on signs. And there's a wonderful interview between Vernant and François Lissarag, published a few years ago by the Institut National de l'Histoire de l'Art, in which Vernant emphasized repeatedly the profound influence that Meyerson had on his thinking. For Vernant, the primal class of objects for thinking about sculpture was the aniconic standing stone. I illustrate here an example of the sort of thing that Vernant must have had in mind, a so-called Argos Lithos from the sanctuary of Apollo at Metapontion. These things, Vernant claimed, did not represent iconically. At issue here was not representation or imitation or resemblance, but substitution and what he called presentification. Vernant extended this model to cover most of early Greek statuary. What we call a statue was, he argued, for the Greeks, a symbole plastique, a substitute or stand-in for what it represented. In a word, a sema. Technically now, this last term, sema, applied only to tomb sculpture, but for Venant, la figure du mort was a paradigm of early Greek sculpture in general. And by extension, I think it's fair to say that he conceived of Greek sculpture generally on the model of semata. In Vernant's semiotic, the sign was basically arbitrary. Its referent can be a dead person in the case of funerary art, a divinity in the case of cult statues, or a sacrificial ritual in the case of votives. All are, in one way or another, absent, hence invisible. The dead are gone below, the gods are elsewhere. The sacrifice is an ephemeral act that slips into the past. But the image, the sign, is a constant presence in the here and now. Hence, the dual function of sculpture is to mark absence while overcoming it, to mark the absolute alterity of the supernatural while giving it a tangible and visible form. In the context of religious thought, every form of figuration must produce an inevitable tension. The idea is to establish real contact with the world beyond, to actualize it, to make it present, and thereby to participate intimately in the divine. Yet, by the same move, it must also emphasize what is inaccessible and mysterious in divinity, its alien quality, its otherness. Je suis désolé que je relis Vernant en anglais, mais j'utilise la belle traduction de Fromme Zeitlin, qui est dans la salle. Donc j'espère que vous me pardonnerez. Alors, even in figural statuary, the image continues to operate in the paradoxical manner of a double. It inscribes absence, emptiness, at the very heart of that which it makes visible as present. The being it evokes, like a substitute, appears in the form of the stone as that which has gone far away, that which would not deign to be there, that which belongs to an inaccessible elsewhere. For Vernant, in short, the archaic figure represents a chiastic interplay of presence and absence, presence as absence. Now, Vernant's arguments have been hugely influential. Prior to his interventions, discussions of early Greek sculpture had tended towards style formalism and connoisseurship, what I was brought up doing. An almost Platonic concept of imitation ruled normal science. In America, for instance, in the work of Gisela Richter, the basic question was to determine how correctly a given statue approximated to real human anatomy. Where a statue stood on a spectrum of correctness determined to a large extent its placement in a relative chronological sequence. Vernant, by contrast, made resemblance seem relatively inconsequential. What mattered, again, was substitution, that is, the production of meaning within systems of arbitrary signs. And this argument has been immensely fruitful. I think it's fair to say that much of the best work in Greek sculpture over the last generation has shown Vernant's influence. Such being the case, it's worthwhile examining the central claim more closely. What exactly does it mean to say that a statue is a sign? In wrestling with this question, I've been compelled to admit that there is a certain... Vernant doesn't make it easy for us, let's say. The problem concerns the absolutely central question of whether archaic Greek statues, especially kouroi, should be called images, whether we should use that word for them, or whether they should be called substitutes or signs. It's a question of whether the early Greeks possessed the concept of an image at all, or whether that concept had to emerge over the course of the archaic period. Another way of putting it would be to say that it's a question of how far Vernant pushed his concept of presentification. On page 40 of Figure Idole Masque, for instance, he writes, Il faut couronner l'édifice funéraire par une image, en kouros, qui traduit dans le registre de la pure apparence visible, de la représentation figurée, la figure du mort, sa forme corporelle. So here the kouros is an image. But then on page 72 of the same book, speaking of the effigies of Spartan kings, he writes, Sans être un iconique, mais en ayant pleine forme humaine, cet idolon n'est pas une image, il ne représente pas les traits de la personne du mort, il présentifie le mort. A few pages later, on page 78, he returns to kouroi. Dans sa forme impersonnelle, un kouros, chacun le sait, n'est pas un portrait, il n'est pas non plus image, Il représente un défunt qui n'est pas vu dans son apparence physique, mais dans son excellence. So what are we to make of kouroi? Did the early Greeks possess a concept of the image? Were kouroi images? Or conversely, were statues semita? Now, some may object that in posing the question this way, I'm missing the whole point of Renan's argument. This is a worry of mine. It sometimes sounds as though he's simply saying that even when the Greeks made iconic statues, they treated them as substitutes for something absent, as though presentification were just a façon de parler. It would be a way of treating images, a question of thematics, even, and not a distinctive mode of figuration. Now, again, in two of the passages I've just quoted, that's not actually what he says. But leaving that aside, I'm reluctant to accept the objection, because I think that his claim really was stronger and bolder. After all, the mere observation that a statue stands in for somebody would commit us to no particular view of figuration, and certainly would not entail a concept like presentification. On the contrary, I do believe that Vernon was making a stronger claim, that presentification, as opposed to iconic representation, was a distinctive mode of making figures. And I take him at his word when he says that kouroi are not images. So if the question is, did the early Greeks possess the concept of an image, then Vernon, I think, says no, they did not possess such a concept, not even when they were making kouroi and karai. They only acquired the concept later, in the classical period. I hope I'm not deforming his arguments. Well, so I want to go back now and look more closely at kolossoi, semata, and the rest. One way to get at these matters is in terms of what one might call the Gnostic quality of signs. By this I mean simply that signs, by definition, require reading or decipherment. Greek calls this act of interpretation noesis, from nous, mind, or anagnosis, coming to knowledge. As Gregory Nagy put it in a classic discussion, reading the sign or sema, be it a tomb marker or an omen or a carefully chosen piece of advice, requires recognition of its place within a coherent system of signals. To make sense of the image, writes Nagy, one must have recognition, noun, nous, verb, noeo, of how the sema works within its code. Vernon, for his part, put the inscrutability of the early Greek sign at the heart of his argument. In the essay, From the Presentification of the Invisible to the Imitation of Appearances, he traced the development of Greek statuary from allegedly aniconic slabs and columns of stone, legible only to a privileged few, to fully fledged images that the whole polis could recognize. Now, many people will, I think, be willing to accept that the Argos Lithos up on the screen is not an image but a sign, and that it requires interpretation. Actually, I have to say that I find the claim worrisome. I'm reluctant to be prescriptive or a prioristic about what can and cannot inherently be an image. Although, to be sure, not everything can count as an image at every time. But I don't find that claim nearly so worrisome as the claim that the kouros next to it is not an image. Of course, that claim is supposed to be worrisome. It's supposed to be shocking. The wonderful, bracing thing about Vernon's argument, of which I think he must have been fully aware, was that the Greek concept of a statue fits uncomfortably into contemporary ideas of what either an image or a sign might turn out to be. It's not quite clear what it means to say that a statue is something that requires interpretation in this way, as Vernon implicitly does, for instance, when he says the kouroi and karai are not images and classes them with iconic signs. Now, to clarify the point, it might be helpful to contrast the Greek discourse of semata, as Vernon presents it, with Wittgenstein's widely influential account of seeing pictures as it appears in the second part of his philosophical investigations. I think it's useful for two reasons. First, because most theories of depiction in contemporary Anglophone philosophy, at any rate, take Wittgenstein as a starting point. Second, because Wittgenstein believed that there was a very big difference indeed between images and signs. He maintained doggedly that the beholding of pictures as such is not convincingly described in Gnostic terms as reading or interpreting. On Wittgenstein's view, in looking at pictures, people don't ordinarily see a set of marks and then interpret them to yield depictive content. Rather, they see pictures, simple as that. To illustrate the difference between interpreting and seeing, Wittgenstein gave the example of a picture in silhouette of an animal transfixed by an arrow, the sort of thing that appears so frequently on Athenian black figure cups that I wonder if he hadn't been looking at something like this. The key question is whether we see the partially occluded arrow or simply know it to be there. The difference, for him, is between just plain seeing and a two-step process of seeing something and then interpreting it or sussing it out, reading it, to stand for something. Do we, for instance, treat the picture as one might treat a blueprint or a technical schematic? That is, do we initially see a set of shapes and colors and then interpret it as standing for a partially occluded arrow? Or do we just see an arrow poking through the body of a deer? In this case, a spear. But mightn't this act of seeing actually turn out to be a sort of reading? Such is, after all, the assertion of semiotics. Wittgenstein argues that the only way to answer the question will be to examine the expressions that people give in such situations. For instance, I see an arrow. What is the criterion of the visual experience? The criterion, what do you suppose? The representation of what is seen. There is no better, more direct description of the experience, no better evidence for what we do than such an expression. For instance, nowadays you can imagine a causal or physiological explanation of the sort a neuroscientist might provide. For Wittgenstein, it would not be of any help for Wittgenstein, for our descriptions do not invoke neurons and synapses, rods and cones. In describing my experience of a picture, for instance, I don't say, now the rods and cones in my eye are registering light and sending electrical impulses into my visual cortex. That's not the experience that I have. If, by the same token, someone were to propose that what seems for all the world like seeing a picture is really, as it were secretly, a process of interpretation, then, Wittgenstein suggests, nothing would be gained thereby. Interpretation, one might say, as opposed to what? Wittgenstein characterizes this theory as proposing an inner materialization of the image, which is then subject to interpretation, reading. But the only evidence to suggest that such an inner interpretation had played a role in the act of seeing would, again, be the outer expression or representation of what is seen. Whether one engages in a mysterious inner process of interpretation or just sees an image without reading it makes no difference as far as the expressions go. As Wittgenstein sums it up, to interpret is to think, to do something. Seeing is a state, and we see statues. But seeing is, even for Wittgenstein, a tangled concept. He also lays great emphasis on what he, following Gestalt psychology, calls changes of aspect in pictures and elsewhere. The famous duck rabbit exemplifies such shifts. You see a duck, you see a rabbit, two aspects of a single drawing. One and the same object produces two very different descriptions. As he says, I see that it has not changed, and yet I see it differently. The importance of aspects lies in the way they reveal the variability of possible descriptions of a drawing. There are many ways of seeing, also of failing to see. Maybe you can't see the rabbit at all, just some black marks on the white ground. But Wittgenstein would insist that these different ways of seeing are not to be confused with differing interpretations. You actually see something different in each case, as opposed, he argues, to seeing something and then going off and interpreting it in a different way. Now, what happens if we put this view alongside Vernon on archaic figuration? Signs, by definition, require interpretation. That semata require noesis. But, following Wittgenstein anyway, images do not. Now, of course, it's perfectly possible that, once the depictive content of a picture is seen, then further interpretation may prove useful or necessary. The transfixed animal might, for instance, be a symbol or something or other, as the owl on this coin is a symbol of Athena. And if you go outside into the arcade, for instance, there's on the ceiling, in the vault, there are pictures of four women. And you can see them as women, Wittgenstein would argue. And then when you read a label, you can see that one is a symbol of Hebrew, one is a symbol of Greek, one is a symbol of Latin, one is a symbol of Egyptian. But the distinction is between the two experiences that one has before and after the reading. Now, but the parsing of such connotations is ancillary to seeing the picture in the first place. You can see the animal in the picture without knowing that it's a symbol. But the question of symbolism will not arise at all if you can't see the animal in the picture at all. You can have the animal without the symbolic meaning, but not the symbolic meaning without the animal. Such allegories are, in any case, fairly rare. More commonly, as Roland Barthes, for instance, insisted in Camera Lucida, the connotations of an image are part of the perception of it. For instance, many scholars, including Fernand, have argued that the long hair and splendid youthful physiques of Couroy connoted epic poetry and aristocratic values. But such a statue is not a symbol of lordly ephebic beauty, one might say. Rather, it represents a youth who is lordly, ephebic, and, by the standards of the day, beautiful. As Vernon himself puts it, it makes those values present. Attention to the ideological connotations that accrue to images is important, but it doesn't reach the level required of the robust semiotic account that Vernon seems to be after. A robust semiotic account must address figuration as such, how we come to see a piece of stone or metal or wood as a statue at all, as depictive at all. In the case of Couroy, it would address the way in which we come to see a body, a hairstyle, a physique in the first place. And such an account is exactly what Wittgenstein seems to deny when he distinguishes images from signs on the basis of whether they do or do not produce expressions of interpretation. Well, so what? Who cares what some Oxford philosopher says? It's tempting to argue that because the Greeks called statues signs, therefore they were signs, simple as that. After all, shouldn't we be reading Greek art in Greek terms? But in fact, that statement would sidestep the problem of historical meaning. For it's only trivially true, a restatement of the lexical definition, to say that a word like, say, sema, can translate as statue. What this statement really shows is that the Greek concept of a sema, one might respond, is that the Greek concept of a sema and the modern concept of a sign are not the same. It is an interesting, a very interesting, and very important historical datum that the Greeks should have lumped statues together with signs, but that datum could be seen as an explicandum, not an explicans. What I'm trying to bring out is the extreme oddity of the kind of statement that I, as classicists and art historians and archaeologists, find ourselves making when we read the work of Jean-Pierre Vernon. Now, I recognize that I'm making this oddity sound like a question of translation. It can come to seem as though an unbridgeable gulf separates our everyday words, statues and signs, for instance, from theirs, sema, agama. In fact, however, translation is, I think, the least of our worries. Because alongside this radical difference of concept, there is a certain presumption of comprehensibility in this situation. Over against the lexical difficulty of equating words like statue, sign, and sema, and agama, there stands the perennially astonishing fact that we can recognize very old lumps of carved stone as depictions in the first place. The images themselves provide continuity between our words, our worlds, and theirs. Nothing shows our kinship with the Greeks better than the fact that we have the words like statue and sign ready to hand to name their artifacts and concepts. Nothing shows our distance from them more clearly than the fact that they identified the two. Our words and the Greeks' words, the language games, are not commensurate when it comes to statues. But, and this is the striking point, for all that, we do see carved lumps of stone as depictions, effigies, icons, and statues. You don't have to know anything about Greece, but you can see that as a statue of a person. We do invoke our concept when we see the stones in this way. Indeed, if we did not do so, then we would literally have nothing to talk about. Given that the Greek concepts of image and sign differ from our own, that's Fernand's claim, if we did not apply our concept, then we would be, in some sense, blind, like someone who couldn't see the rabbit in Wittgenstein's drawing. At issue here, then, is not a failure of imagination, but the limits of historical intelligibility. In short, there must be, at least a degree of commensurability in depictions. This point is important because it suggests that the images themselves, in their beholding, ground the translatability of Greek words like sema and eidolon. The Greeks apply those words to objects which we can recognize, and it is by recognizing them as images, for instance, that we know how to use the words. In other words, we have here a conflict between, on the one hand, a strongly historicist philology, which finds that our words and the Greek words are or seem to be incommensurate, and an ahistorical, aprioristic mode of seeing that is capable of discerning depictive content in certain pieces of carved stone. On the one hand, the Greek concept is said to be utterly different from our own. On the other, we seem to know just what they're talking about. Put it this way, why are we so certain that the Argos Lithos is aniconic? If the Greeks really did make no distinction between what we would call signs and what we would call images, then it should be impossible to state prescriptively that the object on the left is not an image. It begins to seem as though the Greek concept of figuration were like a concise version, a very short, compressed version of that famous Chinese encyclopedia with which Michel Foucault began Les Mots et les Choses. There were entities in Greece that it seems appropriate to call signs, and there were entities that it seems appropriate to call statues. And even if we have trouble identifying the two, nonetheless, the Greeks did just that. The task, I suggest, is not to explain this identification, but to describe its operations. At issue is not the question of whether sign or statue is really a proper translation of sema or whatever. What matters is, as again Foucault put it, the set of other statements in the midst of which the word appears, the domain in which one can use and employ it, the role or the functions it has to play. What matters, in short, is use. What does a sema do? Instead of Gnostic accounts of Greek sculpture, we need a drastic one. After Jean-Pierre Vernant, studying Greek statues amounts to an effort to think an impossibility, or, more precisely, to stay with Foucault, to ask, what is impossible to think? Okay, let's take stock. Vernant claimed that there was an inevitable tension at the heart of the archaic figure. He located that tension between the presence of the sign and the absence of its referent. Juxtaposing Vernant with Wittgenstein allows us to see another, perhaps more fundamental tension, one that's internal to the very concept of a symbole plastique or a presentification. The concept yokes together things that might otherwise seem very different, what we call statues and what we call signs, everyday perception and interpretation or reading. And I've argued that we can't just do away with these terms because we invoke them whenever we talk about these particular objects and identify these objects. But the analogy between these two tensions is remarkable. It suggests that Vernant's internal tension is not simply, not exclusively, to be located at the level of content, as between present gravestone and absent dead, or the dazzling body of the divine and the stone marker. It is rather internal to the depictive function of the statue in its perception by beholders. It is a tension between the ordinary and the inscrutable, seeing and reading. My suggestion is that, of course, kuroi are images. In fact, I don't quite know what it would mean to say that they're not images. And that, of course, the Greeks had the concept of an image, that whatever they called them, they made what I want to say is an image. But that so far from overthrowing Vernant's basic points about substitution, this fact actually enriches them. My time is short, so I can only give a few quick examples to illustrate the kind of drastic account of Greek sculpture that I'm after. What I hope to show are a few works in which the distinctive internal tension that Vernant discerned is visible not in terms of iconographic symbolism, but in terms of figuration, not to use a somewhat old set of terminology, not a matter of semiology, but of rhetoric. For instance, sculptors of the late 7th and early 6th centuries often incised anatomical details onto the body. On offer were, I want to say, the signs of muscles, their markers, and only minimally their iconic depictions. One of the earliest kuroi extant, for instance, is a torso of circa 600 BC from the sanctuary at Sunion. It consists of a four-square block onto which crescents have been gouged to mark shoulder blades, a long line to mark the spine, and so on. Just these incised lines here. Surface modulation is minimal, while a single incision can signify either a depression, the spinal furrow, or a ridge, the scapula. The overall approach has much in common with epigraphy, From a technical standpoint, in fact, there's no difference between the denotation of a shoulder blade and the incision of a letter. Each is just a simple inscription on stone. Anatomical features are on this statue like letters, discrete, iterable, and minimally iconic. Of course, they're not letters, but the affinity is clear from the fact that many early figures do actually have texts carved onto their flesh alongside the notations of anatomy. The votive inscription on an early 7th century bronze Apollo from Boeotia runs in boustrophedon over the thighs. I hope you can see the inscription that's running over here. Such that the root similarity between the two modes of incision, the carving here and, say, the carving up here to mark the locks of hair, or this line running down the middle of the throat, that the root similarity between the two modes of incision becomes evident. Manticlos gave me as a tithe to the far darter of the silver bow, do you, Phoebus, give me something pleasing in return. The mark on the surface of the stone is, in this case, I would want to say, a sign, a sema, of the bones and muscles underneath the skin. Rooting in carving technology, the epigraphical handling of anatomy encourages the distinctive Greek identification of statues and signs. But my point is that the image trades on this feature, that the incommensurability of signs and icons yoked together in the concept of a statue sign of presentification here becomes a productive way to think the functioning of an image relative to the deity. Only a couple of miles from Sunion, in the region of Anavissos, stood a monument that thematizes the distinction between graphic and iconic with even greater complexity. Known as the Brother and Sister Stele, it dates to circa 530 and is currently divided between New York and Berlin. It consists of three parts, an inscribed base, a stele, and a crowning sphinx. The base bears an elegiac couplet. One broadly accepted reading goes, to dear Megacles, on his death, his father and mother raised me as a mnema, a memorial. Although this epigram does not actually call out to passersby in the sta viator formula, still its very existence presumes a reader who has paused, approached, bent to look, and to read. As both Jesper Svenbro and Joseph Day have emphasized, early Greek epigrams were read aloud, and a funerary epigram thus triggers a reenactment of the ritual lament for the deceased, endlessly hauling the past back into the present. In this instance, we speak Megacles' name, we call him our dear one, and in so doing, we retain him in the here and now. Crowning the stele on the top is a sphinx. In the mortuary context, it's usually understood to be apotropaic. The sphinx, or dog of Hades, as one epigram calls her, guards the tomb. Her frontality is confrontational and literally repulsive. Think of everything Vernon wrote on the Gorgo. It repels with a gaze of fear. More recently, Herbert Hoffman and others have argued that the sphinx exemplifies the liminality of the grave marker, its function as a meeting place of living and dead, present and past, in its own strangely composite body. The sphinx is a hybrid marker of a hybrid place. This view also has much to recommend it, and indeed it complements the apotropaic argument nicely. There's thus a marked antithesis between the sphinx at the top, which is literally repulsive, and the epigram, which is implicitly attractive, come and read. This distinction is, in fact, a basic organizing principle of the monument. The sphinx, for instance, has her own special connection with poetry. Sophocles described the Theban sphinx, adversary of Oedipus, as poikiloidos, a hapax which Liddell and Scott translate nicely as of perplexed and juggling song. For Euripides, her riddles are musai, musics, amusotatai hoidai, most unmusical songs, and diskzunetos aiodos, an unsolvable song. Now, the mythological relation of the Theban sphinx to the sphinx of tomb sculpture is uncertain, but Athenian vase painters certainly conflated the two. They show the Theban sphinx posing her famous riddles from atop a column or a slab, in clear allusion to funerary and votive sculptures. On our grave stele, the incomprehensible song of the sphinx stands in marked contrast to the eminently legible description. The lucidity and specificity of the poem, its task of rescuing the name of Megacles from obscurity, has its antithesis in a figure of enigmas and riddles. Just so, where the text is read aloud, the sphinx's unmusical music is never redeemed from silence, cannot really be spoken. Her mouth is closed, and in general, the silence of images is a commonplace of Greek literature, as in Simonides' famous remark that painting is silent poetry. In short, where the inscription gives us resonant verse as truth-telling, guaranteeing the commemoration of the dead in and through the legibility of a text, the Sphinx, with her perplexed or juggling song, gives us just the opposite, the silent poetry of an unanswerable enigma. These opposites frame the central shaft. Megacles and his unnamed sister stand poised between clarity and riddle, poetry and non-music, attraction and repulsion, low and high, epigram, text, and Sphinx, statue. For my purposes today, the important point is that the sculptor presents this structure as a progression of medium, from the incised text on the bottom, to shallow relief in the middle, to a full three-dimensional sculpture in the round at the top. In this simple triad, the inscribed poem is the most abstract, most symbolic element, but it is also, when read aloud, has the most literal acoustic presence in the here and now. The Sphinx, by contrast, is the most striking, most confrontational, and the most compellingly plastic in the three dimensions. Yet her song is silent, implicit. Between the two stand the dead, their low relief assimilating them to the incised words, their sheer iconicity assimilating them to the sculpted Sphinx. The in-betweenness of the represented figures, shimmering between two and three dimensions, presence and absence, sculpture and writing, is an instance of Vernant's internal tension in practice. But it is a tension that only becomes apparent when, as here, we recognize a distinction between image and sign, Sphinx and script. Dead yet remembered, vanished yet tangibly present, Megacles and his sister exemplify this distinctive in-between state, this internal tension at the heart of the early Greek image, which is the work of the inscription and the Sphinx to delineate. Thank you.